This is Fresh Air. I'm Tariq Gross. My guests are two police officers who know how drugs can kill a neighborhood and why it's so difficult to put the dealers behind bars even when you know who they are. Sergeant Tom Leisner and Detective Jim Moffitt are two of the people credited with breaking a cocaine and crack ring in the Philadelphia neighborhood of Spring Garden, which was run by the Ramos family between 1985 and 1990. The head of the family, Richard Ramos, is serving a 30-year sentence. The prosecution ended earlier this year with the conviction of the plastic surgeon who altered Ramos's appearance while he was a fugitive. Sergeant Tom Leisner started the city's first community-oriented police mini-station in Spring Garden. Detective Moffitt is a plainclothes officer who also worked with the Drug Enforcement Agency. We invited them to tell us about their experiences. Detective Moffitt said that in the late 80s, Ramos ran one of the three street corners in the neighborhood that were open-air drug markets, which attracted people from outside the neighborhood driving through to make their buys.
So a lot of times you actually had gridlock. Up in the neighborhood. People that are going to drive through from Pennsylvania, Delaware, New Jersey, it didn't really matter when. And then you had your walk-up traffic. And then you had the people that were hanging on the corner from the neighborhood that were working there or at least hanging there. And then you had the pipers. They're pretty much zombie kind of guys that are just out there to clock a little time to sell a couple bags to get enough for their own bag. They may work a half an hour. So you had a lot of people. And then because it's the kind of neighborhood that it was.
Now, what about the impact of violence on the neighborhood from the drug traffic, Tom?
Well, that was noted. I mean, clearly, one thing you always had happen is when crimes were committed in the perimeter of the area. The reason they were done in perimeter areas because if they did them inside the area where they're doing the drugs, it would bring police in. So they would commit the crimes outside the area, which would pull the police away from the drug area. And then while the police were in the outside looking for the people that are doing the crime, they would come back into the area and sell their proceeds. And it just kept running and running and running. Violence among the three groups was almost non-existent. You didn't have one corner fighting the other corner when they were established. Each corner kept to their own turf and didn't bother anybody because they all had their same activity. But violence committed by each corner on people coming in for whatever reason. Somebody wanted to come in and buy some dope, had a whole lot of money. Somebody might beat them with a baseball bat, take their money.
The most violence that I saw up there had to do with gag bags. And people that are going to come down into a known selling area. Now, let's say, for instance, 17th and Mount Vernon is selling hot one night, and there's a lot of people lining up for the dope. And then maybe on the 1600 block, somewhere in the middle of the block, somebody else will come in, and they'll bring in what appears to be drugs, but aren't drugs at all. And they'll try to stop a car that's on the way to the corner and sell the dope as if they're working for the group that actually controls the corner. If they're spotted, then everybody on the corner runs down, and that's where these baseball bat beatings go to. So if you were working a police car, you would see somebody suddenly attacked, and then when you moved in, these guys would just disappear into the crowd or into the buildings. But the guy that was selling a gag bag is going to take, you know, a beating.
Now, because you both worked in this neighborhood for a long time, you knew the head of the Ramos family that sold a lot of these drugs. You knew him when he was a kid. So I'm wondering if you could each just share some thoughts about watching this kid grow up into a drug lord and being responsible for the community that he was helping to ruin.
He was a cute little blonde-haired boy. When he was, I guess, 7 or 8 years old when I first met him.
Mm-hmm.
And he had just a little bit of a speech impediment, a little slur in his speech. And a lot of young kids come up to marked units, and I was working a marked unit back then. And they'd want you to turn on the siren for a second, or they'd want to take a look at your stick. They were always looking through the window. If you're parked on a corner in Spring Garden or, you know, in that kind of neighborhood, kids are going to come over to you, and they're going to talk to you. And you get to know them, and you ask them questions. And then one of our duties when we first came in is you had school crossings. And so you would get to know these kids like at 8 o'clock in the morning when they were going to school, coming across. All cops have nicknames. And, you know, if you talked to them the day before, they would, you know, call out your name, and now they know you, you know them. So with Richie Ramos, he would come over a lot. I would talk to him a lot when he was young. And he had two brothers, Jerry and Edwin. And Edwin was much more standoff. Jerry was kind of fast talking, very smooth kind of guy. He was shot to death later. And he was like the little guy that hung out with the two older brothers. And he had some sisters. And he had a mother that was very much out on the street. They had carts, hot dog carts, and stuff like that. So it is true that we knew Richie early and talked to him a lot. Which doesn't say much for my counseling skills.
Tom, did you see this coming? Did you see that Richard Ramos was kind of heading to a life of crime and drugs?
No. I mean, I knew Richie. I probably met Richie back in 73, 74 when I first came on. And like Jimmy said, he was just a nice kid. And he was just a neighborhood kid like everybody else out there playing around, and didn't see any kind of inkling that he was going to be leading towards drugs, even though we knew in the probably late 70s that his mom was selling drugs out of her house. And you always have a feeling that, well, maybe the kids won't get involved. But apparently it didn't lead that way. But there's nothing as a child that I could see that would lead Richie into that life.
I'd like you each to describe for us the positions that you held on the police force in the community during the reign of the drug families in the neighborhood that you were in.
Well, in 87, I started the first mini station in the city, 17th and Wallace. In fact, it was a 1702 Wallace. A year later, it moved over to 1700 block of Wallace on the corner. It was me, Officer Tom Bray, and two other officers who have since retired. Our goal was to go into the community because it was drug infested and see if we can make a change. And we were giving anything we wanted, work any kind of hours we wanted, just go out there and try to do the job and try to put a dent into the drug trade.
Now, it's my impression that you kind of had two goals in the community. One is to try to get information to help break the drug rings, but the other was to try to help people in the community.
That's
what were some of the things you could help them with?
Jobs. First, we started out with showing to the people that they could trust us. And we did that by every Saturday cleaning the area. We'd get up down this every Saturday, we'd go down and clean a different block, get all the cars moved, get out there, you know, in our plain clothes, and actually shovel the dirt with the people and show them that we're taking a concern. How about you getting involved and taking a concern with us? You know, we're here for you. Why don't you work with us? People wanted to get jobs. People wanted to go into drug rehabs. We were there available for them. If people had problems with the landlord-tenant dispute, we would advise them where to go to get the help.
Detective Jim Moffitt, what were your positions on the force during the period when drug families took over the neighborhood?
I started plain clothes in 1981 and worked what's called a burglary detail, and I was mostly interested in arresting for Part 1 crimes. And there was a lot of Part 1 crimes going on in that neighborhood.
Part 1 crime is?
Theft, robbery, burglaries, various kinds of assaults. And you tried to do mostly sight pinches. You did a lot of surveillances. You got them in a position where you actually watched them commit the crime, whether it be a purse snatch. You used to watch people set up women for purse snatches all the time. Watch them break into cars or watch them try to steal a car and then make the arrest. We got to know everybody up in the upper end. My partner was a Spanish cop, Carlos Rivera, and he knew a lot of people in that neighborhood. I got to know a lot more people in that neighborhood. And then when finally the drug situation got so out of hand, I was assigned to a new partner whose name was Jerry Logan, who's now a sergeant. And we were told to go after 18th and Wallace, 17th and Mount Vernon, and 16th and Wallace, and to close them up.
When you were on the burglary detail, did a lot of the burglaries lead back to the drug trade?
A lot of the burglaries did. The burglaries, really, in Center City and in the Upper End, led back there. You'd be out there at 1 o'clock in the morning, you'd see a guy coming up the street with a trash bag with an antenna sticking out of the top and a plug coming out of the bottom. And, you know, you'd watch them turn over that TV and get a couple bags, and you'd grab the TV and start working backwards. And, you know, sometimes you could actually get right back to the house that was burglarized. Or somebody would bring in a stolen car, try to turn the car over on the corner, and because you got to know these guys on the corner, they really weren't interested a lot of times in picking up stolen cars. It's just going to bring heat to the corner. And, you know, they would say, you know, so-and-so keeps on bringing these cars around. And, you know, we'd start sitting on those corners and picking off stolen car thieves.
So the drug dealers were ratting to you on
the drug dealers have got to keep the flow going. Because every time a police officer comes onto that corner, they have got to shut down. If they shut down for half an hour and they're selling a bag every 2 minutes, it starts to get pretty expensive.
Now, I'm glad you brought this up about how they have to shut down if a cop comes on the corner, because I'm wondering, how can you keep this, like, thriving drug traffic going where there's gridlock because you've got so many cars backed up waiting to buy? I mean, it's so blatant. There's cops in the neighborhood. How can they sell that blatantly with guys like you around?
Well, it's a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week thing. So let's say it's a Friday 4 to 12. You have 5 cars, 6 cars, whatever the manpower is in a district or in a part of a district. Well, at the same time as you have these drug sales going on, you have robberies going on over on Broad Street. You have stolen cars. You have hospital cases. You have disturbances. You have purse snatches. You have car stops by a car. Well, somebody has to back that car up. So you can keep on going back to that neighborhood, but you're a slave to the radio. You are always involved with jobs. These things are just keep on happening. Well, these guys keep on selling. As a matter of fact, sometimes if we spent too much time out there, these guys would grab some Piper and put him out in a corner, let you witness a sale. Of course, you're going to lock up the Piper. You have to. Well, now you're stuck with this paperwork, and so you're off the street. They know that. So they would actually, you know, once in a while throw a sacrifice out to you to keep this flow going.
Sergeant Leisner, now, you know so many people in the neighborhood. You must have known at the height of the drug trade who the big dealers were, who the head of the crime families were. So when you walked past one of these corners and you knew who everybody was and you knew who was a player, what could you do about it?
Nothing.
Why not?
Nothing at all. And law state, you got to see him doing something wrong. And, you know, we knew in the very beginning when Richie took the corner over from people that would just talk to us that Richie owns the corner. And Richie fought somebody for the corner, beat somebody up, gagged him, beat him up, and took the corner over by force. We all knew that in the very beginning. And myself was realizing that here's a kid that's only 21 years old that has a corner, and he's working, and you can't touch him. And unless somebody is going to come in and say, Richie's doing the drugs, and I'll go to court and testify on his behalf, you'll never be able to touch Richie.
Would everybody stop the action when you'd walk by?
Yeah. Hey, well, what they do is all three drug corners stepped down at the time. They all had lookers, and it was just like an organization. You have people that are lookers. You have people that are shift bosses, and you got your managers, and then you got your big boss. It's just like a business. And the lookers would be on the corner just waiting for to see a police officer walk down the street to tell the dealers to cut the action out until the police would leave.
So the lookers were scouting for the cops. If you walked past a looker,
yeah.
Could you slip by?
Yeah, you could slip by. I personally earned a kind of respect, maybe because a lot of people knew me. If I got close enough to a looker, he might have been talking to somebody on the corner when I was walking down the street and didn't see me. If I got close enough, I could just look at him and just shake my hand in a no gesture, not to say anything. And he would just stand there or he would walk across the street. When I got to the corner, the person was selling off the corner, may have had his back towards me. And the person he was selling to was probably looking down in his hand, trying to pick out the biggest bag of drugs he could buy for his $10. And I'd be able to walk down and just look right over his shoulder and make an arrest.
How often could you do that?
I can probably count maybe in the 3 years I was up there, maybe 6 or 7 times I've done that, which is, you know, quite a few times considering I was in full uniform.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll tell you how bad it is. I mean, when people buy drugs, they're not looking at who's wearing what. I was standing on the corner one day, and I ended up locking a lady up. This was maybe 2 o'clock in the morning in full uniform on my radio, talking to a bunch of drug dealers who I was chasing off the corner. This lady comes up into the middle of us and says she wants to buy 5 caps, which are 5 little plastic vials of crack cocaine. And I look at myself and I said to her, I says, "Do you have the money, ma'am?" And she says, "Yeah." And she gives me $25. And I look, I says, "Do you know who I am?" She says, "You're selling." I said, "I'm a police officer." And she was amazed that I was a police officer in full uniform, and she gave me the money. I ended up locking the lady up.
Was she already very high?
Yes, right. Yes.
My guests are Sergeant Tom Leisner and Detective Jim Moffitt of the Philadelphia Police. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Sergeant Tom Leisner and Detective Jim Moffitt of the Philadelphia Police. We're talking about their work in a Philadelphia neighborhood that was controlled by drug rings in the late 80s. Some people say that if there were a real economy where people could get real jobs, that a lot of people wouldn't turn to selling drugs, but that some of the people who do sell drugs are really savvy businessmen.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm wondering, based on your experiences, if you think that some of the drug kingpins that you've come in contact with are really pretty smart.
Yeah, Jimmy can answer that because he was with them when he was working with DEA. He was with their asset people.
Yeah, the people that are running the show a lot of times are very smart, but they're not smart in all ways. I mean, they're clever. They've got a lot of information that they're working on. They know our limitations, just like we know some of their limitations. On a corner drug scene like that, when you have all these people hanging on the corner, really from the community, when you sit and listen to their conversations aren't about the drug business. The drug business is going on while they're hanging on the corner. They're talking about a million different things, some of which are interesting. Most of it, there's really nothing happening here. These are guys that are just standing out there. There's nobody talking about school or anything like that. They just hang, and they're just idle. And this is what they do, just waiting to make a couple bucks.
But they do have a sense of sales.
Yeah.
When they first operated the corner, they were trying to get people to buy their drugs. They had a 2-for-1 sale. In 80...
Price to go.
Yeah. In 1988, Easter of 1988, Richie Ramos came up with a great idea for Easter time. Why not sell something that's different that nobody else has? And what he did is he colored his crack pink. And he was selling pink crack on the street at Easter time. There was nowhere else in the city or in the tri-state area that you could buy pink crack cocaine. And people swore by this drug, saying, "This is the greatest high I've ever had." And all it was food coloring.
Yeah.
But as far as sales went and marketing, they know what to do.
Yeah. A.T. Tamales actually had jackets made for themselves.
You're kidding?
No.
Like tour jackets?
Yeah. They were red jackets with their names on it and everything?
Solceros.
I'll tell you what's a great help to us sometimes is graffiti. They'll write the name of everybody in the whole organization out there. So what do you have to do first if you're going to take out a whole group of people? You have to identify them.
Yes.
You go over and find yourself some graffiti, and you'll see everybody's name on there.
Now, how do you each deal with crack houses in the neighborhood?
Well, crack houses aren't places where crack is kept. Crack houses are places where people go smoke some crack,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of them don't have plumbing or heating or electricity or anything else. A lot of the windows aren't windows; they're boarded up. They're usually dark places, and the people that are going in there, they're like the living dead. They go in there and they'll smoke a little crack and they're out. There was, I guess, 3 or 4 pretty well-known crack houses up there. And, you'd go by sometimes, for me, if I was looking for a stolen VCR and actually had, like, an identification number, I could go up to a crack house, because I knew the people that were in the crack house, and ask me if anybody brought a VCR in, and, you may wind up walking out of there with a VCR. Sometimes you went in and talked to the people and got people out that other people had asked you to get out.
Okay, so you're a cop, you go into a crack house, you walk out maybe with a stolen VCR, but What about all the people smoking crack there?
Well, they're not going to smoke crack while you're coming into the house. You don't see the crack. There is not a big pile of crack anywhere. Crack is little rocks of cooked up coke. So you're not going to get a lot of crack in a crack house. You'd have to be crazy to bring a lot of crack into the crack house, because everybody in a crack house is smoking crack. Anything can happen. And everything does happen in crack houses.
It must feel like such a game sometimes. You know, the cops know who the drug dealers are. The drug dealers know who the cops are. They see each other at work. They're in the same neighborhood all the time. And yet things can keep status quo for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you do. You get to know these people. You talk to somebody. I mean, you know, you may talk to them for 15 or 20 minutes sometimes. You tell them, you know, you guys better knock this stuff off, you know, so on and so forth. But, you know, they go back to their business and we're off to another call. When everybody really gets focused on something and it becomes an unrelenting attack on a corner. But that's manpower intensive.
Detective Jim Moffitt and Sergeant Tom Leisner of the Philadelphia Police will be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Sergeant Tom Leisner and Detective Jim Moffitt of the Philadelphia Police. We're talking about their work in the late 80s when they helped break a cocaine and crack ring that had taken over the Spring Garden neighborhood of Philadelphia. The drug-dealing street corners were obvious, but often hard to focus on because there were so many other calls to respond to. Detective Moffitt says they got the manpower they needed in 1989 when the Drug Enforcement Agency teamed up with the city police. He worked with the DEA.
We were able to get surveillance places through Tom, and we were actually able to get in close enough to get right up and watch deals. Now we can send undercover people in there, make deals. We have pre-recorded money. Now if we go in and we buy... See, when you go up to a corner, you don't go up and ask to buy a kilo. It doesn't work that way. These are nickel and dime guys. But if there's a... you make more money breaking down a kilo into dime bags than you do selling a whole kilo. A lot more money. So, but then again, you have more employees. You have to hire all kinds of people, and you have to have stash houses, and you have people coming over to pick up the money, and then you have people that are going to bring the drugs in. Somebody has to be set up so that they can see what cars are bringing it in. Okay, so we're looking for a green Chevy. You know, now, you know, it's by steps. You take steps. This gets into long-term investigations. A long-term investigation is really the way to take out an entire organization. Because if you're just doing individual arrest every day, then what do you have the guy for? You have the guy for 10 caps. Then somebody's going to come in and say, well, that's personal use in court. And they have an expert that'll come in and say personal use. We'll have an expert that says, that much crack indicates that he's sales. Now, it's a lawyer thing. Then the case gets continued. So now that it's continued, everybody's back out on the street, you know, selling the drugs. So you can have guys out there with 5, 6, 7 open cases. They're still out there. Nothing changes. One of the things that happens when the federal government comes in is they, once you have this group of people, you're now going to take off this organization. They have a thing called pretrial detention. Pretrial detention is a powerful tool because you can now go in and actually take out an entire corner, and nobody's going to be back selling dope later in the afternoon. When we hit 18th and Wallace, for instance, we came in first with the police and rounded up, I don't know, it was 40 people, I think, on that. And then right after that, we had moving vans from the DA's office, and we were able to empty out the apartments that we could prove were stash houses. And then after that, we had L&I people come in with, and this, by the way, is all in the same day, with the cinder blocks, and we blocked up the houses and the apartments. It became a ghost town really overnight because so many people were involved in it.
Sergeant Leisner, what were you able to do to help Detective Moffitt set up surveillance sites? You were working in full uniform doing community policing at a mini station in the neighborhood.
Yeah, whenever Jimmy needed a place, I would scour the area, try to find out which corner he wanted to work at, and which advantage point would work the best. And I would talk to people that I trusted in the community, mm-hmm. and people that had been long established, and that would be mostly Hispanic people, if they would be open to allowing a police officer to come into the premises. And a lot of them at the very beginning would say, well, you know, I don't want a police officer coming through the front. And we would make arrangements to have the officers come in through the backyard, even if they had to hop over four or five fences to get into that. It wasn't too hard. I mean, a lot of people wanted the drugs out of there, but they were afraid in the open to say anything. Richard Ramos had a lot of power in that corner. He had a lot of people scared. You know, people would actually be out there and see people get shot, get beat with baseball bats, and they were afraid to talk in the open about Richard Ramos. After we got a little bit of trust, they wanted the drugs out of the area. They knew that, not to say that they don't trust police in general, but because they had such a rapport with myself and the other officers at the mini station, they trusted us a lot, and they knew that whatever they did with us wouldn't go anywhere else, just our ears.
Now, what are some of the ways that you were able to trade information when Detective Moffitt, you were working plainclothes with the Drug Enforcement Agency, and Sergeant Leisner, you were doing community policing at a mini station in the neighborhood?
Well, Jimmy would call me up and says he wants to know who's working the midnight shift. Maybe there might be two new people
on the street selling drugs.
On the street, that's correct. And I might be working day work. And he'd say, Tom, I need this information for tomorrow. I want to know who's working the shift. I would stay. I would stay till the midnight shift started at 12 o'clock. And when the midnight shift started at 12 o'clock on the street, I would get a surveillance. And I would go out there and I'd be in plain clothes. And whether it means going to somebody's house, going on top of a rooftop and sitting there with a pair of binoculars, I'd get the information for Jimmy. And sometimes I'd be there like maybe 3 o'clock in the morning. And I wouldn't go home. I'd stay at the mini station. A lot of times people saw my car there at 4 o'clock in the morning and they'd be knocking on the door and I'd be sleeping in the chair because I knew I got to get up at 7. And I would wait for Jimmy to come in the next morning and I would supply him with the information.
Now, Detective Moffitt, when you were working plain clothes on the burglary detail and then for the Drug Enforcement Agency, you'd worked that neighborhood for so long, everybody knew who you were.
Oh,
it's just because you weren't wearing a cop uniform didn't mean people didn't know you were a cop.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So how did that affect your ability to do your work?
Well, I couldn't do any kind of undercover work there. And when I went down, let's say that we wanted to do a surveillance that included the northwest corner of 17th and Mount Vernon. But we couldn't get them to leave the 1600 block of Mount Vernon. If my partner and I went over and parked on the 1600 block of Mount Vernon, because we're obviously police, they'd move the deal over to exactly where we wanted to be. What they don't know at that point is that Tom has given us a surveillance spot and we've got a camera hooked up covering that location. So that in kind of an opposite way, being a known plainclothes guy has helped out because they're really watching Logan and I. But what they don't know is that right down the street is the guy that they better be careful of because he's the one with the camera.
Yeah, it's funny that Jimmy mentioned that because it's true. Like, if he wanted to work a certain corner because he couldn't get at the other corner, I would just go down and stand on the corner that he wanted to work. They would force everybody down to the corner where he was sitting. And he could just sit there and watch them tell. So my presence on the corner is that they're thinking, oh, Tom's here again, you know. They don't think anybody else is in the area, but my thing to be there in that corner is to force the trade down where I can't see it, but down where Jimmy is.
Right.
So it really works out great for us.
It's kind of like conspicuous patrol.
Yeah.
Conspicuous patrol.
Yeah.
To force the movement where you want it to
yeah,
go.
Yeah, right. You're going to set up your own little thing here. You want the lighting right. You
right.
don't want to film into afternoon light. I mean, you know. If you have some experience in surveillances and things like that, you can make things happen. You just have to figure out what it is that you want to have happen and then try to come up with the way to make it go the way you want it to go.
My guests are Detective Jim Moffitt and Sergeant Tom Leisner of the Philadelphia Police. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Sergeant Tom Leisner and Detective Jim Moffitt of the Philadelphia Police, we're talking about their work in a Philadelphia neighborhood that was controlled by drug rings in the late 80s. Was there any one thing that you would say broke the Ramos family drug case?
Yes.
What?
A guy who has a long record,
mm-hmm.
A guy who was a target of mine, a guy who I had known only in a very hostile way for a long time, contacted Tom, and he said that he wanted to talk to us. So we thought about that because the Ramos people aren't a pretty violent crowd, you know. And so we decided that we would meet him, but we wouldn't meet him anywhere in the neighborhood. We met him down the Delaware River. It was a cold night. And there was some question as to whether or not we were all going to get shot, you know. So we had our people out there, and he showed up, and he seemed so sincere. And, you know, you get suspicious as a cop. He seemed too sincere. And he said he wanted to do this and do that. So I said, all right, well, let's meet. And I had him come into our offices, and he became a CI, a confidential informant. And he was a shift boss for the white tape cocaine end of it. But that's right across the street from the pink crack. And he was trusted. He had arrests, I guess, for being a pimp and, well, just everything. I mean, he turned out to be some guy. As a matter of fact, one day, and I know we don't have time for police stories, but one day we wanted to hit a house up on this very small street up in another neighborhood that was a stash house. And Jerry Ramos, we knew to be in there, and this other guy whose name was Dirt. And our guy was supposed to pick up some dope and bring it down to the corner. But Jerry Ramos, a smart guy, sensed that there was something wrong. We had heard that. So I wanted to send this guy into the house, and I wanted him to wear a wire. But didn't feel good about it because, you know, if you're wearing a wire, you know, you can get searched. So we talked about it back and forth, and I said, look, I'm not making you do this, and I'm not even asking you to do this thing. But what I'd like you to do is go in there without a wire. And see, there's some wires that we can hear outside. Mm-hmm. They're not just tape recordings. They're actually. So I said to him, look, if you run into, and I mean, you can't even get close to this house. You have to be pretty far away. I said, if it comes to it, you know, pick up a piece of furniture and throw it through that front window. I'll get over there as quick as I can. And he didn't even think about it. He went right in there. And sure enough, he got in there and they stripped him. And lucky he wasn't wearing a wire. And then we turned around and whacked the place with a warrant that we already had, but we wanted everything to be there, you know, when we served the warrant, because like anything else, drugs come, drugs go. There's not always drugs in any drug house. There's not always drug people in every drug house. Sometimes you're just going to run into the mother-in-law.
Why do you think this guy, Punchy, informed the drug family that employed him?
On the day of his sentencing, in front of Judge Du Bois, who is a judge that really listens. Punchy had a chance to talk for himself, and this is what he said. He said that he started feeling bad about it, and then one day he saw a pregnant woman come up that was going to buy crack, and he said that all he could think about was that baby. That's what he said.
And what's he doing now?
He has a job, a full-time job. He got his son back. He's married. He's living in another part of the city. He's working full-time plus. And I was with him a couple of weeks ago, and he was complaining about taxes and all the things that go along with home ownership and middle-class morality.
So how is he managing to do this without getting killed by the people who he betrayed?
There are only a couple of people who went to trial. Everybody else cooperated. Everybody else gave up. Everybody else. Everybody wanted to make a deal. And as a result of that, they didn't get the mandatory life sentences or mandatory 30 years or mandatory 20 years. Some of them got, I don't know, 6, 7 years. Mm-hmm. I think 8 years was maybe the average for a lot of them. And some of them are starting to get out, and somebody saw him, and they got his phone number, and he was just talking recently to somebody. Now, he said, what do you think I should do? I said, I wouldn't visit the guy. I mean, you know, I'd be real careful. But he doesn't go where he used to go. He doesn't hang with people he used to hang with.
What's the neighborhood like now? Still a lot of drugs getting sold on the street, crack houses in the neighborhood?
Not that I know. I know I was talking to somebody recently who told me that there were, he told me that there were 6 arrests up there last year, and I think 2 of them were for marijuana dime bags. Now, that neighborhood, and I drive by there, you know, on my way to other locations, I don't see anything. You see young guys out in the corner, they may occasionally be selling some drugs, but nothing that would bring us into it.
No more traffic jams.
No,
I mean,
being I'm back in the community now as a supervisor, I mean, I've had a chance to work the midnight shift. And when I worked the midnight shift there before, I mean, you couldn't count how many people were walking down the street. There's just so many. Now, I went down there the other night, two people.
Yeah.
Big change.
I'm going to ask you to speak as individuals, not as representatives of the police force or of the DEA, but based on your individual experiences in the neighborhoods, cleaning up a really bad drug problem there, what do you think the police can do to break up neighborhood drug families?
It's important. The most important people in the police department are the sector car guys. The guys who drive those blue and whites are by far, in my mind, the best chance that this city has. No matter how wonderful the equipment the DEA gives me, or no matter how much money we can get to buy drugs, if we're talking about local neighborhood drug sales, the thing that is our best weapon is information. And the only place that the information can come from is the people itself. You can bring me out and I'll set up an elaborate surveillance, but it's that lady that lives the third door down from the corner that knows most. And it's that sector car that knows most.
My feelings are just a little bit different. And I agree with Jimmy saying that sector car is important, but I know that we don't have a large police force like we used to have, so our manpower is a little short. I feel that the community's got to get involved, because without the community's help, the drugs are going to keep thriving. And the sector part is very important, but I don't think he can get involved now as much as you could 10 years ago when you had a lot of police officers on the street. And I think that's why people are pushing for more police officers. That officer that works that car, he has radio calls that has to answer. And he cannot spend as much time in an area where there's drugs as he would like to make the arrest, to get the information. It's important that he gets the information and turn it over, but I think it's very important that anybody involved in the community that doesn't want the drugs there, they have to call, and they have to call the right authorities. They have to call the narcotic unit and give them the information. Any information they supply over the phone is going to be confidential. Nobody will know who called. You don't have to give your name. You just got to give people places and things and what they're doing.
So are you saying that you think ideally there should be strong community groups working with police in the neighborhood?
Sure, because if the police come into the neighborhood to do something and the community's not behind them, the community's actually hiding the perpetrators inside their community. Because they want it to thrive, because maybe it's because that person that's on welfare is getting $100 every time they either put drugs in their house or they put money in their house. I mean, where can you go being on welfare and somebody says, listen, I'm going to give you $100. All I want you to do is just hold this money in your basement, not even in your house, in your basement, and I'll give you $100. People take that up right away.
It is. You know, when you have a surveillance and all the probable cause and everything goes into this particular house, and then you get a warrant and you hit that house, and what you find is a welfare mother with six children, and she's going to go, and she's going to get locked up. And she did it for $75. Mm-hmm. And we've done it over and over again.
A prime example was two houses down from the mini station. We got information the lady was holding yellow tape product for 1600 block of Wallace. I gave the information to Detective Moffitt and Sergeant Logan. They hit the house to find the drugs. It's a lady, nice lady, very nice lady, always out there helping clean the streets. She was holding drugs inside the house. They find the drugs. She has three kids. She ended up doing 18 months in jail.
And what happens to those kids? And what are those kids now thinking about the police that just went through that door? They're scared to death. They scream. And there you are standing there with this sledgehammer and a vest on and all kinds of police things emblazoned all over you.
But of course, none of this is going to stop you from arresting the welfare mother who's making the $75 for keeping the stash in the basement.
No, she goes.
But your feelings are different.
My guests are Sergeant Tom Leisner and Detective Jim Moffitt of the Philadelphia Police. This is Fresh Air. Back with Sergeant Tom Leisner and Detective Jim Moffitt of the Philadelphia Police. We're talking about their work in a neighborhood in Philadelphia that was controlled by drug rings in the late 80s. Sergeant Leisner, you have been doing community policing for a long time. And for several years, you were working in this little mini station that was kind of an experiment in Philadelphia.
Yes.
In community policing. What do you think of the experiment now? Do you think it's effective to be very visible, very based in a neighborhood, have a little mini station there, interact with people from the community?
I think so. I mean,
not be driving around in a car.
I think so. I mean, the police department has always done community policing. I mean, we go back into the 50s, you had the B-cop. He was doing community policing, except he wasn't working out of a building.
What could you do at the mini station that you couldn't do if you were driving around?
Get closer to the people.
Mm-hmm.
Sit down when they have a problem. You're in a car, somebody comes over to you and says, my daughter's on drugs. She ran away. All you're going to do is, she's a juvenile, man. You're going to take a report, and you're going to classify her as a runaway or a missing person. That's it. Case finished. You go home. At the mini station, when that job comes into me, we'll go out and try to find out where the daughter is. You know, we have that much leeway. We're not tied down to a car. We're not tied down to radio calls. It gives us a lot more freedom to work with the community. And I find it self-gratifying to actually spend 4 hours talking to somebody with a problem they have. And you can't do that in a car.
Now, your mini station had a grenade thrown through the window.
Yes.
During the height of the drug problems. You're the person who found the grenade.
That's correct.
What, you were sweeping up the glass and...
Yeah, what happened was I was working the day work tour duty. And as usual, I had went home that night, but I had left my car there. I had gotten a ride with somebody else. I come back in at 7 o'clock in the morning because I had to go to court. And when I come back in, there's a police car outside the mini station and the front glass is broken. I asked her what happened. She said, somebody threw a big rock through the window last night at 3:30 in the morning, and I've been sitting out here because the property is open. I said, all right. So I go inside and I look at this big rock which went through the big plate glass window. It's laying on the ledge. And I didn't think nothing of it. I mean, this is not the first time somebody broke our window, I mean, just because they don't like us. So I started cleaning all the glass up, figuring I have plenty of time before I go to court. And as I was doing so, I realized I was getting close to going to court. It was 9 o'clock. I figured I had to make a phone call. I go behind my desk. I pick the phone up, and I'm calling court attendance. And I look down. I see this World War II pineapple hand grenade, the kind you see in the photos. Now, my first instinct was that it's probably a dud. So I looked at it, and I bent down. I looked at the bottom of it, looking for, like, a hole that they usually drill in them, saying they took the powder out. And I didn't see any. And I thought, this is not right. And I called bomb squad right away. They came down. We evacuated the neighborhood. They came in and looked at it and had to treat it as a live grenade. And I asked the officer, well, how do you know it's a live grenade? He says, well, we're going to implode it. He says, if it blows up after we blow it, it'll be a live grenade. But if we take it and we blow it up and everything pushes down into the floor, it'll be a dud. Well, unfortunately, it blew out and just destroyed the whole building. It was a live grenade. For whatever reason, it just didn't go off.
Wow.
And my feelings are that it was because this happened August 20th of 1990. And in April that year, we had locked up 18th and Wallace.
Yeah.
And Mount Vernon Street was next. Yeah. And our feelings are, Jimmy and mine are saying that they were taking it out on us. Other people are saying, Richie Ramos claims it was what was his words?
Richie said it was Jerry Ramos's last wish.
His wish.
That he blow up a mini station. Richie's already told us that, you know, that he had hired the people to do it. And that changed a lot when that happened.
What did that change?
It certainly changed my attitude a bit. I mean, it suddenly became...
personal.
Deadly serious.
I mean, before they... I mean,
I like Tom, but it was also a nice building.
I mean, there's numerous things they've done to me, not to my person, but to my car in the area. I mean, I came down one October for Halloween to take some children out of the area. When I got down there, about 9 kids showed up, and I couldn't fit them in my Datsun. So one of the ladies from the community said, I'll take you in my car. She had a station wagon. So I left my car there. Took the kids out. When I came back, all 4 tires of my car were flat. And I've had broken windshields. I've had my battery taken out. I have 2 radios stolen. just because I park it there and I go on patrol, when I come back later, just trash it. But it's also a good feeling, because if they hate you that much, you must be doing something right. And that's how we felt about the hand grenade, in a kind of way. I mean, they really must have hated us that much to throw a hand grenade in the mini station just to try to destroy something.
Did the community rally around you when they realized what danger you'd been in?
Very much so. They had a vigil mass the next night. I had a couple common plea judges that lived in the area at the time came down and helped clean up the place. And it was nice.
I'd like to know what keeps you both in your jobs as cops. They're dangerous jobs. A lot of people don't like cops. A lot of people don't trust cops. It's not an easy time to be a cop, because the bad guys are very well armed. Yeah. And there's a lot of public distrust of the police. Mm-hmm. What keeps you in the work?
I love the work.
What do you love about it?
Well, I love that I'm consumed by it. I mean, I know that sounds crazy, but this is my chosen field. I like going up against the bad guys, and I like it every day. There are some days when I think, geez, I got 20 years, I had to get out of here. And actually, I would go out right now, but I love the battle. I love the chase. I love it all. And another thing is that once you have a certain number of years in the job, well, where are you going to go after that? I mean, am I good at? I'm good at arresting people. I'm good at my job, and I like it, and I like it every day. And I like working for the people. And I do like going into places like Spring Garden or places in West Philadelphia or other places where we've done good jobs. And you take some pride in that. So,
Sergeant Leisner, what about you? What keeps you in the work?
Yeah, mine's the same as Jimmy. I mean, I enjoy the work very much, even though now as a supervisor, it's a lot less stressful. I just go out there and supervise my manpower and make sure that they're doing the job correctly. I think it's just gratification, just trying to help people, trying to put an image in somebody's mind that the police department is there for you and that you can trust us. I mean, I think it's always been like that for me. I just like to have the trust of the community, that they can trust me and have somebody they can turn to when they need somebody.
I want to thank you both a lot for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sergeant Tom Leisner and Detective Jim Moffitt of the Philadelphia Police.